Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Neurodiverse Teacher Podcast. I'm really excited to have you here, and I'm especially excited for today's guest. My guest is Sivan Hung. Sivan's career spans over two decades in several industries and professions, including holding esteemed positions as a professor at New York University Stern School of Business and former partner at the Bridgespan Group. Today, Sivan authors and illustrates the best-selling children's book series, The Super Fun Day Books, including Benny J. and the Horrible Halloween, George J. and the Miserable Monday, Emily D. and the Fearful First Day, and Avery G. and the Scary End of School. Her inspiring books focus on neurodiverse children who overcome challenges with perseverance and bravery. Sivan also serves as a trustee on the board of the Rita Allen Foundation, Multicultural Children's Books Day, and the ASPCA. Wow, that is a lot of stuff. Well, welcome, Sivan, to the show. I am really
so much
you're here.
It makes it sound much cooler when you say it.
No, but I love it. And I have to immediately jump into the fact that you make books for children who are neurodiverse. And first off, let me praise you in the fact that you do that, because I think that is amazing and so needed. So right off the bat, please tell me how you got here. Tell me everything about your journey in life that led you up to becoming an author of children's books about neurodiversity.
Like many of us, I didn't know that I was neurodivergent as a kid. I struggled with reading. I struggled profoundly with spelling. I remember feeling like a failure in second grade when I came home with an F on my report card in spelling, because back then that's what they gave us grades in second grade, and could never wrap my head around books. And so the idea that I would become an author was by far the farthest thing I could have ever imagined, because I didn't like anything to do with books. But when my kiddos were little, both of whom got diagnosed, one with autism and ADHD and the other with ADHD, I realized that this is genetic, and there are lots of things that they do that I do. And got diagnosed myself, which was great, because as a family, we all high-fived each other and my poor husband felt totally left out. But that's an aside. But when my oldest son was in kindergarten and he needed to wear headphones for sensory issues, mm-hmm. I really struggled to get him to do it because it didn't feel normal. It didn't feel cool. And I was looking for a book to mirror for him that this is okay, that lots of kids wear headphones and it's kind of like, you know, wearing a hat. It's not a big deal. And I couldn't find a picture book that showed a child wearing a set of headphones and talking about why they would wear them. And so I said, you know, maybe I should write one and put it out there. And that was the impetus to get me to start writing, because I realized that there's such a dearth of these kinds of books out there. And since I started writing, I've seen so many more of them, mm-hmm. but it's still just a drop in the bucket. And, you know, one of the things that they say about children's books is that, you know, they can be a mirror into your life and you can see somebody else and it makes you feel normal and okay. And your difference is okay. And we need these kinds of books for our kids. But even more importantly, I think, is the neurotypical kids to be able to open a book and see a picture of a child wearing headphones and be like, oh, the kid in my class who wears headphones, that's not weird. That's just fine. That's normal. I see that every day. And to me, we need both of those things, and books serve as such a great tool to do that.
You know, that's such a valid point. I think oftentimes we think, I want my child who's neurodiverse to see something be normalized. But you're right. Children who are also neurotypical need to see things become normalized in order for it to really be something that is normalized. So I like that. You know, I don't know that I'd ever even kind of had that thought popped into my head, and it is so important. And so I'm so glad that you are doing this and that you are writing these books, but I imagine you had to have a very different kind of professional career. I mentioned in the intro that you were a professor at New York University Stern School of Business. So Tell me a little bit about that. That had to be kind of a career transition for you a little bit.
So yes, my background was in business. And frankly, before that, I have a doctorate in international relations, which has nothing to do with children's books either. and really kind of was in the business world. I focused a lot on nonprofits because to me, you know, that's half the fun is getting to do good. But then when my eldest was diagnosed, and we were fortunate, we got him diagnosed around 2. Mm-hmm. My husband and I realized that there was no way we could both work those kinds of careers and invest in him in the way we wanted to invest. And I had felt like I had accomplished so much professionally at that point that I was more than happy to kind of raise my hand and say, you know what, I will pull back and I will dive into this world with him. Mm-hmm. And look, it's a gift and a privilege to be able to do that. And I recognize that so many families out there are not in that position, but I was fortunate enough to be in that position. And I think, part of me feels like I owe it to everyone else that if I was to do that, then I need to do something more than just focus on my kids, but that there has to be kind of a bigger picture to it all.
Oh, wow. That is really beautiful. And I do like that you're doing that. And I do feel that messages like this are so important because one of the biggest things I come across with the students that I work with is they are afraid of being seen as being different in any kind of way. And I think, you know, I also was ADHD undiagnosed growing up. So we mask so often to try and hide this idea of being seen as different in any kind of way from our peers, because we're so afraid if people think we're different, that we'll be made fun of, or people will think we're less than in any kind of way. So I love that you're creating these stories. And one of the things that I saw, to me, this is at least a key word, is perseverance. You used perseverance in a way and how it describes what the purpose of your books is in helping kids overcome challenges and to persevere. And I'm going to ask you, when you think about perseverance, what are some of the things that you feel like hold kids back from being able to persevere, especially neurodiverse children? And it can be a broad of like what's happening in our society, what the kind of message they get, but what are some of these things that you think make it so difficult for children to either persevere through the challenges of being neurodiverse and being afraid to be seen as being different?
Look, I think first and foremost, no kid likes to feel different, right? And while neurodiverse kids have a specific type of difference, you know, the kid who's too tall or the kid who speaks a different language or has a different religion or is in a different ethnic group, nobody wants to feel different, right? They all want to feel cookie cutter. And so I don't think that trait is unique to our group of kids. But I do think one of the traits of being neurodivergent is that you have a low frustration tolerance, mm-hmm. right? And so perseverance becomes harder for us, right? Because we get frustrated so much faster. And there, you know, in many cases, there is a high level of perfectionism and a real frustration around failure. And so being able to overcome and say, I'm not as good at something as somebody else, or I don't like to feel different, I think those feelings feel bigger in neurodiverse kids than they may feel in neurotypical kids. And so the way we respond to those feelings, I think, has to also be equally as big, right? And look, the world has come a long way, right? This idea that, you know, famous people will stand up and say, I'm neurodiverse would never have happened when I grew up in the 70s. And the only idea that we saw of anybody who was neurodiverse was Rain Man, right? Like that's what people thought. And in many cases that's going away. It's not gone completely, but there is that stigma. And there is this notion that when your child gets diagnosed, like that's the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I think it's normal for parents to go through a mourning period because you mourn this idea of what your child was going to be. And every parent has an idea of what their child's going to be. You know, like when they're in the womb, you're like, I wonder what they're going to be like and who they're going to marry. But when you get a diagnosis, that disconnect between who your child is going to be and the reality is so much more stark, where a neurotypical parent goes through that slowly over time as they see their child develop. And so I think there's that recognition too that needs to be in place, that's like, no, this is going to look different. Mm-hmm. And different's okay. And different is good. And different is beautiful. And there can be an incredible sense of pride that comes with that difference. I always believe that it has to start at home. Mm-hmm. I believe that parents need to see the gifts that are in their children, because if they don't, I don't understand how they could expect the rest of the world to see them, right? And so in our house, of course, there are moments that are hard, right? Mm-hmm. Parenting is hard. and I don't want to sound like, you know, all roses and sunshine, but when we talk about our neurodiversity, we talk about the strengths that come with it. We talk about how lucky we are to have these gifts. And when my youngest was diagnosed with ADHD in second grade and I told him about it, and he looked at me with this earnest face and he said, Mom, I'm not going to tell my friends. And I was like, okay, that, you know, that's obviously your choice. And he's like, because I don't want to brag. And I walked away and I'm like, okay, that's a parenting win. We are exactly where we need to be. And I think that needs to be the mindset around mm-hmm. neurodiversity, so yeah. that difference, which is not going away and shouldn't go away, should be celebrated.
I am 100% with you. I often speak on neurodiversity on a regular basis, and I try to explain people that I don't look at neurodiversity as being better than or less than being neurotypical. To me, they're on the same playing field. The problem is we as a society have put so many negative connotations with being neurodiverse. You know, the word disorder is in almost every neurodiverse diagnosis that there is. So we automatically have this negative connotation that comes with being neurodiverse, but it's not. It really is your brain, if you're neurotypical, sees and views the world and processes information one way. And my brain, being neurodiverse, sees and processes the world a different way. And there are pros and cons to being both. The gifts that I have in being, you know, ADHD, and the things that I can do as far as understanding information quickly or working well under pressure, like, those are some of my gifts. And you're being able to show up on time and remember where things are some of a neurotypical's gifts, right? So, I mean, there's pros and cons to everything, but I feel like a lot of what the challenge is coming through is this kind of connotation that society has created in what it means to be neurodiverse and what that looks like. And I'm so happy to hear that your parenting win of your son turning to you and go, because I don't want to brag. Because I think that is so beautiful, because I think so many other times it's because the only way to get the right type of supports or services that you need as a student who is neurodiverse, you have to have so many stigmas associated with it. It means going into special programming or being labeled or identified a certain way. And people put these negative concepts around it. And I think that's what kind of perpetuates this cycle. And in all honesty, most of the strategies that go into place for kids who are neurodiverse are just good teaching strategies or good education or learning practices yes. that research shows that every kid yes. would benefit from. But we continue to push this idea that it's negative or something is wrong with you if your brain takes in information and sees it a different way. And I don't know if that is what you have experienced. And I'd be interested to hear, since it sounds like you also were not identified, or were you identified as being neurodiverse when you were younger? And what did school look like for you because of what some of the challenges that you were going through were?
So I was not identified as a girl. You know, we mask brilliantly. And yep. and nobody thought anybody would have a girl would have ADHD when I was in school. Like
it was just little boys who were hyperactive, right? Right?
Right. So like that wasn't even a thing. And for me, the real struggle was around language and books and writing and you know, I got through high school on Cliff Notes because there was no way I could get through any of those books, right? Like that was just, I could not focus on a page long enough to comprehend it. Yeah. And since then I have found audiobooks work brilliantly for me. And I know they don't work for everybody, but for me, I can focus because it allows me to multitask. Mm. And I have the kind of brain where if I'm doing more than one thing, I'm doing those things really well. And that so that I can listen to the book and I can do whatever laundry or whatever it is that I'm doing. And that works really well. And so I've been able to go back and reintroduce myself to literature and fall in love with books all over again. And I've introduced that to my children as well, because I see their struggles with sitting down and staying focused on a book. And if I give them a book in the form of an audiobook, they can comprehend books that there's no way they would have been able to read. And we can talk about what's going on in those books. And the way I think about it is, you know, you don't tell a blind person that they're not reading because the words go into their head through their fingers. Why would you tell me that I'm not reading because the words go into my head through my ears?
100%.
Right? Like, please, what matters is what we do with it once it gets inside. And so, you know, I have advocated for my kids to be able to listen to audiobooks for their reading time and advocated that there are different things that they can do during the day. And I have this amazing school system that's very open to listening and very open to partnering. An example I will give you is 2 years ago when my son was in fourth grade and I discovered that, like me, he needs to kind of multi-process in order to really pay attention. Mm-hmm. I discovered this because I couldn't get him to sit down and watch a movie, even if it was a movie that he would love. He just could not sit still. But if I gave him a switch and he would watch the movie, then all of a sudden, everything is great. He comprehended everything and he didn't have to look at the screen because he was listening, but he got the whole movie. And so I was like, I wonder if that will work in school. And there's no way they were going to let him have a switch in the classroom while like the teacher was working. But they let him, but the idea came up and I was like, well, let me give him a Rubik's Cube. Mm-hmm. And so he sits there in class and he'll do his Rubik's Cube while he's listening to the teacher. And he can pay attention and he can absorb all of that information. And I recognize that not every school is going to be okay with that, but this school is okay with it. And when there's a new teacher, he'll go advocate and say, this is how I learn. I can't look at you and focus. If I'm looking at you, it means I'm not paying attention. The way I pay attention is by doing something else. And so I'm teaching him to advocate for the way he learns. Mm-hmm. But I'm also very thankful that I'm in a school district that's okay with that kind of different approach. I mean, like you said, schools are not structured for our kind of learning, right? If they were, then kids would always have movement breaks and all kids could use movement breaks, right? Or checklists or all these other things, all these great tools that we use. But right now they're only accessible for our kids. There's a stigma attached to them and you have to be the parent that advocates for them.
Yes.
Right. Like, it's like, you need to know the special sauce.
And that's one of the most frustrating things. I mean, I come from a background where I was a special education teacher for many years. So I know what those things are to ask for, or, you know, or say I need, but my most recent schooling is the fact that it was mind, brain, and teaching. And that's why I say that all the things that we are doing for neurodiverse kids, every kid benefits from. And we also have to realize that not every brain, it's like a machine. Not every brain is the same machine. It doesn't do things the same way. And I'm so glad that your son's school is open to kind of allowing him to have that multiple things going on. Because I have worked with clients of mine where it has been a similar situation where the child does so much better when they have like an iPad where they can be drawing on it while they're listening to the lesson. And we tested it this one time with the school. And we essentially said to the teacher, you know, allow them to go ahead and draw and then let us know how the engagement goes. And we checked back in with the teacher and were they more engaged? Actually, yes, they were way more engaged and they answered more questions and they knew exactly where we were and what we were talking about. And then I go, okay, so have you allowed them to continue to do that? No. Well, why not? Like, you've been complaining that they're not engaged and they're not willing to participate and we have found the solution. Why wouldn't you allow that to continue? And I think, again, there's so much of this mindset that you're only paying attention if you are looking at me and you are intensely taking notes on it. Like, that's what paying attention looks like. And for people who are neurodiverse, especially with ADHD, it doesn't. And I mean, I even experienced that as an adult in the education field. I had had times where I'd sit in meetings and I'm typing away and it doesn't look like I'm engaged in the meeting. And I'd have people, it was very obvious that they were trying to call me out and catch me in the fact that I wasn't paying attention. And they'd ask me a question and I'd right off the bat, like, blah, 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 like, here's the answer to your question. Like, I'm listening to everything that's going on. And actually I'm more engaged because I'm multitasking, but that seems to be a concept that a lot of people just don't seem to pick up on or understand, that people do have brains that can do more than one thing at a time. Some people can't, but some people can.
That's right. That's right. And look, like, the notion that at least they can have fidget toys in school and all the, I mean, like, I'm sitting here with my spinner because there's no way I could sit through like the whole time.
Right.
Like, this is how I function. But like, when I was a kid, I would use paper clips or I would use, you know, the like dry cleaner hangers, and I would sit there and I would bend them and you'd come up with all these things anyway. Right. Like, we found a way to do it.
Oh, I used to use, because fidgets obviously were not a thing when we were kids. I did ice skating fingers. My fingers would just be like this figure skater on the desk because I needed to be doing something to entertain me while I was listening to whatever the teacher was saying. You're right. I mean, we came up with things now that I wish we had had fidgets when we were younger. That would have been a lot more entertaining than ice skating fingers. So let me ask you, you talked a little bit about this, but I want you to kind of maybe give a little bit more. How do you think being a parent to neurodiverse children shapes your parenting style? It sounds like you give really positive messages. It's something that you obviously talk about, but how do you think it impacts you and your parenting style per se?
I think I'm much more understanding, and yet because I've walked in their shoes, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't really care if you can't spell this word, right? Like, I was just looking at, my son had to kind of work on an essay and there were a ton of spelling mistakes in it. And I'm like, I don't care. Right. Like, that to me is not something that really matters because I survived just fine and I can't spell anything. There are places where I'm just like, this doesn't matter. Like, I'm not going to stress over it. I don't care about your handwriting. Nobody writes anything by hand anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are things that I'm much more laid back about. And then there are also places where I think I'm tougher on them because I won't let them use the neurodiversity as an excuse.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm like, no, I know what that feels like. I get it when your brain is overwhelmed and there's 50 million things on, you know, going on and you need one step at a time. I understand that. But also, this is life. And this is, you know, we're not changing the world to accommodate everything. And so in those places, I think I can be harder. And so I think it's this weird balance of my parenting approach. But I also think I'm super tough on myself as a mom, as a result. And I think all moms are really hard on
themselves. I think we all are. Yeah.
But it's that kind of the perfectionism that is, as much as I rationalize it in my head and know that that's what I'm doing and that that's not a healthy approach, it's still there. Right. And it's like, well, why didn't I do this? And why didn't I? And then you're just like, okay. But that part is still very much part of who I am.
Now, do you use any kind of systems or anything in place that you feel like would be a good thing to share, or that you have found to be successful that really help your children with either, you know, organization or executive functioning, or some of those things that we just know are harder as an individual who is neurodiverse?
So I do a lot of modeling, mm-hmm. right? Because it's one thing for me, you know, and I used to have like, we used to have the boards with all the little schedules and whatever. And I love schedules and my kids love schedules, but I'm like, it can't, my kids are now 11 and almost 9 and they can't have me doing it for them their whole lives. Yeah. And so now I'm like, well, create a schedule for you. What time are you doing your homework? What time are you doing this? And I'm forcing them to do it. And then they see that I do it as well. Like my phone goes off with alarms constantly because otherwise I forget to do everything. So yep. this way, like, you know, there's like 7 alarms in my phone and I'm like, oh, okay, this one has to go here. But they see that I'm using it and they see that I'm setting myself to a schedule so that the world doesn't completely collapse around us.
I like that. Now, where do you feel like, you know, I had somebody ask me this question this morning and I actually was like, wow, that's not an easy question to answer. So not that I'm putting you on the spot, but I think it's a good conversation type of question. And we were talking about where does it become a reason, you know, why something is difficult. You know, it's a reason, you know, we all know that burnout is significant with people who are ADHD, that, you know, executive functioning is hard, that sometimes even just completing tasks can be hard. And she wanted to know, where is the line between it being a reason and it being an excuse? And I'm just curious. And that was not an easy question for me to answer. And I want to see what you have to say. And then I'm happy to talk this about you. And again, not putting you on the spot, but I thought it was a really interesting question when you're trying to look at it from what is the difference between a reason and the difference between an excuse.
So the way I do it as a parent, and that's a hard one because you're constantly second guessing yourself, is I'm okay if you're not going to do something at this moment in time, but there has to be the accountability that says this is when you will do it, right? The I'm feeling overwhelmed, I'm feeling burnt out, I'm feeling all those things is legitimate and that's okay. But then when is it going to happen? And it needs to happen. And that's where it can't just be an excuse that it's not going to happen, then it's not going to get done. So when my kids push back on reading homework, I don't want to read right now, I'm feeling whatever, I just need a break. I listen to that because that's true. But it doesn't mean that they get out of the responsibility of doing their reading. It's then, okay, and I put it on them, when then are you going to do your reading? So that responsibility, that accountability is still there, right? Like, I don't want to raise them to think that every time they need a break and every time things are overwhelming, it means that everything gets erased from their slate, because the real world doesn't work like that. And they can take the break when they need the break, but then that means that we don't have an infinite amount of time in the day. It means teaching them that they have to then be accountable to do it when they said they're going to do it. And look, there are times that we all have horrible days, and on horrible days, this is for all kids, right? Like, okay, fine. Like, you're having a horrible day. Well, we'll regroup tomorrow. There's always tomorrow. But I don't want it to be that, oh, I'm neurodiverse, and so therefore I don't have to do X, Y, and Z. That just doesn't fly.
I love that. And I want you to know that I gave pretty much the exact same answer. So we are at least very aligned in our thinking on that. And that was what I essentially equated it to. I said, you know, I think there's a reason. And when you know about being neurodiverse, you can say, here are my reasons for why I'm struggling. But the excuse is if you think you don't have to do anything, there really should be some kind of plan of action of how you're going to essentially finish or achieve that goal. And that's essentially what I heard you say. So I think we were at least very aligned with that thing. So that makes me feel good. So thank you for taking that challenging question. Because when I was asked that, I was like, wow, that is, I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. It was a great question, but it's definitely not an easy one. So we're aligned and I like that. So Thank you.
That doesn't surprise me that we're aligned. No,
it doesn't. It doesn't. But it makes me feel good. It's a little bit of validation there. So I appreciate that. So it looks like you also spend time, I was perusing your website at one point in time too, and it looks like you also go into schools and you speak at schools or you read your books at schools. Is that also true?
Yes. And oftentimes I will talk about a lot of the things that happen in the story. So, mm-hmm. so it's not just me reading the story, not that reading a story is a just thing, but we talk about the feelings and we talk about the things that we see in the school, in the story. And all of my books are structured like social stories. Mm-hmm. So they're very specific, right? And there's an order and a structure to them. And so it allows them to be a really good teaching tool. I have on my website for anybody who's interested free teacher guides that were created by a special ed teacher and a school psychologist who went in and she wrote them based on the books and then tested them with students, and they're available for free because I do this out of a kind of a labor of love and not for any other reason. Mm-hmm. And so I use a lot of those tools in my conversations with kids so that it becomes this thing that teaches neurodiverse kids that they're cool and okay, and teaches neurotypical kids that everyone in their class is cool and okay.
I love that. And how do you feel like kids generally respond when you go in? Do you feel like you get a good response or a deeper understanding from some students?
I do. And it's amazing when I hear things like, oh my gosh, that's just like me. Right? That's me. I finally seen myself in a book. And look, my books are also, I mean, they're picture books. They're for, you know, 3 to 8 year olds, but all of the characters are very diverse. And I do that for a reason, because so often the media looks at neurodivergent kids as white males.
Yeah.
And as we know, that's a problem, because girls are underdiagnosed and girls of color are even more underdiagnosed. And so, you know, one of my books has a girl, two of my books have girls of color as the protagonists in the story, because I want them to see themselves, right? I want that to be seen as normal.
I'm getting like chills, like full body chills on everything that you're saying, because it is so true. And it does make such an impact for students to be able to see themselves in teachers and stories and be able to know that they're not alone and that they're represented. So thank you for doing that as well, on top of your amazing authorship as well. I'm just so excited about everything that you were doing and the fact that this even exists. You know, I don't even know that I had even thought about the importance of something like having your books out there. And as we're talking, it is so impactful for students to be able to read this and for them to be able to really get to see themselves and be represented and really contribute to the normalcy that needs to come about of how people view neurodiversity. So let me ask you this. If listeners right now wanted to learn more about you, about your work, wanted to reach out to you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
So I have the benefit of being the only Sivan Hong on the planet, which is really helpful in terms of finding me. So my website is sivanhong.com, and you could reach out to me there. And then I'm also on Instagram a lot, and I do a lot of advocacy posts on Instagram, and you can follow me at Sivan_Hong_author, and you can DM me there and I respond to all of them. So you can reach out that way as well.
Oh, that is fantastic. And before I ask you the question that I like to ask all my guests, is there anything that I didn't ask you or anything that you want to be able to share today that I didn't get to touch on that you feel is important for listeners to know?
The one thing that makes me feel really proud about the books is that I illustrated them myself, because so often picture books can be very distracting for our demographic of kids. I remember kind of reading them and the story is about one thing and my kid will be pointing to a little bird in a tree in the back of the picture and asking why the bird is red, which has nothing to do with the story. And so the illustrations in my book are very purposefully simple. So to help the kids stay focused on the story, and all of the font is dyslexic friendly so that kids with dyslexia can follow along. And they're all also available as audiobooks, because as I said earlier, that's the way I consume words. And so I want to make them accessible for anybody and any kind of learner. And so for me, that was kind of very important.
I love that. I absolutely love that. Well, again, just thank you for your amazing work and for thinking and being creative and putting this out there, because again, so needed and necessary. But I want to, before we close out for today, I want to ask you my final question, which is, if you could send a message to students or young adults right now that might be struggling with school, either academically or socially, what message would you share with them?
It gets so much easier. The school system is not designed for our kind of brains. And once you get out of the school system, then the world awaits. And there's so much more flexibility after you get out of school, and so much more recognition of what our brains can do, that it gets easier. An example I love to use for parents who are scared that their child has been diagnosed with dyslexia. Harvard University did a study a couple of years ago, and they looked at astrophysicists, those with dyslexia and those without. And the ones with dyslexia were like 4 times more likely to be able to identify black holes and things in the universe than those without it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is such a huge asset in that profession. And those kinds of things exist all the time for people who are neurodiverse. You just have to find the place where your strengths will give you the advantage, and it exists out there. So it gets easier.
That is such a great message. And I can't thank you enough for everything that you do, for coming on, for sharing your story, for sharing your books. Again, please go and check out Savan. Check her website out, savanhong.com. Her books are up there. And can people purchase your books too from your website or on Amazon? Where can they find and purchase your books?
So they can purchase from my website. They can purchase from Amazon and Barnes and Nobles and all of the normal places that you can buy a book. And I also love supporting the independent bookshops, so they're there as well. They're super accessible.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. And thank you to all my listeners for checking in, tuning in. And I look forward to seeing you all next week.